This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. Just a few years ago, the town of Anam in southern Nigeria was known for all the wrong reasons: high levels of crime and knife and gun violence. But not anymore. You know why? Because of these women. They are known as Umu Ada. There is a video of them on the BBC Igbo's social media pages. They look like your regular grannies, no offense to grannies. They are wearing traditional clothes and carrying around their kitchen spoons. But don't be fooled by their appearance. When things got tough in their community, these women decided to take matters into their own hands and confronted violent criminals with, you won't believe this one, well, yes, with their kitchen spoons. BBC Igbo's Adeline Okere has been reporting on this story, and she begins by explaining who these women are.
They are the Umu Ada of the Anam society, or the community, where they predominantly speak Igbo. These women are married to or daughters of the community. So Umu Ada meaning Umu, children, Ada, girl child. Everybody in this particular sense is Umu Ada.
Are they considered the elders of their community?
Not quite. So they're a mix of newly married women into the community, and they're the old women who are now aged. Some of them have lost their husbands. But one thing resonated very clearly with these women. They were willing to die for what they knew and what they believed. They were willing to die for their community and make sure that the place was safe.
Tell me about the work they've done around this violence in their community. Just paint a picture of what the situation looked like before these women stepped in and how it has changed today.
Okay, so they started in 2019, and before 2019, it was almost a dread to go to the Anam community. It's around the bank of the River Niger, so at some times of the year, like between the rainy season and almost towards the dry season, which is around November, October, November, it's almost impassable because of the overflow of the River Niger. So because that area is sometimes inaccessible, some criminal elements take the opportunity to, you know, foment trouble and house themselves around there. You might be aware of oil excavations going on around the Niger. So these women discover that young boys go there to either dig up sand or dig beneath the earth and get some crude oil. So sometimes some fracas break out between people who are engaged in this kind of illegal activities, and it then results in some kind of violence. And then because their community is just at the bank of the river, they kind of meted with all kinds of people and violence that, you know, ensue. It climaxed at one point where somebody stabbed another person in broad daylight. So they said, no, that this was the height of it. If the men who were the vigilante who couldn't do this job, they would take it upon themselves and, you know, take up the security of their society. So they had a meeting among themselves, because I think they meet every month thereabouts. So they met and told themselves they were going to make sure that their community got a gate and they were going to set up a curfew time. So they literally start manning the gates, or start womaning the gate, as the case may be, from 8 in the evening till 5 a.m. in the morning. And they would take turns among themselves to do it. No car, no motor vehicle could move through the community. And they would stand there with their cooking spoons.
I love that image.
And they would tell everybody, get off your bike and push your bike all through to where your house is. Push your car until, even if your car could start, push your car to your house. if you can't come in before 8 p.m. So that was the way they curbed the menace of that, you know, wanton, this killing or just the fights that just break out. It's totally stopped. And this was something that men tried to do for years. And in 5 years, these women made everything normal.
That's incredible. I think there's something really, I don't know, kind of scary about a mom telling you, you cannot come back later than this hour.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I believe, you know, it was just the fear of that. They had a few people who challenged them.
Of course.
But the courts took their side and said, listen, if the entire society agree that it would be an 8 o'clock curfew. And the man said, yes, but how can these women tell me what to do? They said, well, if the whole society agreed it, they're only telling you that you should obey what the community said.
They
changed the trajectory of that community. And when we went there this year, we discovered that they did a handing over ceremony back to the men to say, now we have secured our society. We want you to take it up upon yourselves to make sure that this continues.
This is how you do it.
Yes.
We taught you how to do it now. Now just get on with it.
Exactly.
I love it. And are these women elected or are they volunteers? Do they get paid for their amazing work?
No. Umada, you come into it. I am an Umada. For instance, if you come here with Christian, you a name, and then also you would become an Umada.
Wow.
Yes.
I like that idea.
You don't have to be elected. You don't have to be selected. You volunteer yourself willingly. And it's an institution. It dates back pre-colonial era. Yale University has an article that a professor wrote about what some of the people who observed their activities in pre-colonial era saw them do. They made sure that when a woman doesn't do her bit in the home to take care of her children and her family, they would make her do it. They wouldn't force her or, you know, manhandle her, but they would come as a, you know, bunch and say to her, madam, you need to take care of your children. They're starving. They're not eating well. Do you know what to do? Should we teach you or should we show you what to do? Then if a man was engaged in domestic violence against his wife, they called it the sit out. My dialect of Igbo will call it ndugide. Mm-hmm. So they will sit out at his hut outside, all of them. So every female in the society will come and sit outside his hut, you know, until he knows that he wouldn't be able to go to farm, he wouldn't be able to earn a living, he wouldn't be able to do anything until he promises them that he would never lay his finger on his wife.
Mm. So it's kind of like a grassroots community intervention, basically.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
These women are respected and they have authority. Yes.
They have authority. Even the ones that are not title holders, they're not chiefs or anything. You know, they're just basic housewives. But the fact that one of them can stand for the right thing and all of them support her, they're very revered. So men don't like to get in the business of Umada. When the Umada say they want something to stop in the society, it doesn't take 5 minutes. Trust me.
I love this concept. Adeline, tell me about the kind of decision making these women are involved in. What kind of decisions they make for the community?
But the community, they make sure that, you know, there is justice and peace.
Mm-hmm.
If there are, you know, some kind of factional fighting or there is like this insecurity we saw, they come together and decide what they want. And they tell, you know, whoever is in power, if it's the traditional chief. Or right now that we have three systems of government in Nigeria, the federal, the state, or the local, they would go to whoever is concerned and air their views. So even till now, they're not in the kind of fashion that they were in pre-colonial days. We now have meetings, women meetings, where women come together and say, this is how we want things to go in our society. We don't like the fact that there's no road or there's no hospital. We want a hospital. I could give a quick example about another story I did in 2020. We traveled to a society in Abia State, present-day Abia State, that had no hospital, no school, nothing. And these women, when they saw us there, they asked us why we were there. And we told them, we came here it was a fascination for us that there's no school, there's no hospital in your society. And they said, oh, we've been asking the government for this, but it seems that our voice is not loud enough. So we would like to, you know, let it be known. So a lot of them came forward and showed us how some of their children had died because there was no health care, how, you know, a lot of things had gone wrong, and they were ready to put their voice behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it forms a community of women that lends a voice to people who don't have a voice. Mm. You know, the people who the society looks down on, you know, they take care of those kind of people. They're women filled with wisdom. They're women filled with a lot of dignity. And that's what they felt like they could bequeath the society and the community that they live in.
Mm. That's a really interesting point. You know, wisdom, knowing your community, caring for it, genuinely caring for it, and the impact it can have. So what was your experience going there, reporting on this story and actually meeting these women?
Okay, so when we heard of the story, we were thinking, okay, Amazons of Anam. You know? And we're hoping to meet, you know, women who were cladded in, you know, the full regalia. We met mothers, we met sisters, we met people who you would talk to in your little local community, but they were strict about the decisions that they took for the community.
They meant business.
Business, yes. Exactly. And they got it. They got what they wanted. Mm. You know, in Nigerian history, I can trace it back to 1929 when the women, we called it the Aba Women's Riot, when taxes were going off the roof beyond what people could afford. They hit the streets. Some historical references say that some of them were shot at that riot. But the fact remains that it made a statement that is unforgettable, that even almost 80 years after, or over 80 years after, the Aba Women's Riot of 1929 is something to always remember. It talks to us about when women would stand up and say no to what they feel is injustice. Mm. And to be honest, we could use a bit of that today.
And Adeline, you briefly mentioned that you yourself are an Umuada in your community. So speaking to these women, seeing their work, has it inspired you? Are you going to change the way you guys do some stuff?
Absolutely. You know, so I was speaking to a few people from where I come. I'm from Imo State, and one of the communities around the airport, where the airport is located, from the airport to my home has terrible roads. Terrible. There's a part of it we call a river because you literally can't go there with any kind of motor vehicle. So people have to wade through, you know, to get there. And I was talking to one or two persons and saying, what can we do to make sure that the relevant authorities can look at this road and do something about it? People in labor, people who are dying.
Wow, yeah.
People who need immediate response can't get it. They have to wait the number of hours it'll take them to crawl through and wade through water, if there is water on the road, or crawl through the road to get access to the main town. Mm. That's one. Two, some parts, you know, as a community, we, where I come from in Imo State, we had to come together, donate money to get electricity, which was launched in 1999. And the women also played a very, very important role in that. So I've seen a whole lot of stuff. I feel like it's not just for my community, but we could actually put our hands together. Lots of communities in the Southeast where I come from don't have light. They don't have water. They don't. And it'd be nice that they can get water. You know, education, for instance, is also lacking in some instances. So these are some of the things that Umuada come up for and stand for and say, listen, we can't let this happen. Mm. And I mean, I'm at different levels having conversations with people who can make sure that these things are provided for the society.
Adeline, thank you so much. Adeline Okere and the Umuadas that are taking girl power to the next level. Love
thank
that.
You.
Thank you.
Editor Adeline Okere from BBC Igbo. You can see the video of the Umuada in action on the BBC Igbo social media channels.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Farina Kamiti, and this is The Fifth Floor. Sometimes as journalists, we have to travel far away to cover a story. And sometimes we find our best stories on our doorstep. That's what happened to Subhagunam Kenan from BBC Tamil. He often reports on complex environmental issues, but one of his most successful stories is about a battle between ants, which he filmed in his own backyard. Subhagunam, tell me more.
It started quite unexpectedly, right at the doorstep of my house. One evening, I noticed an almost theatrical confrontation between ants. One ant had impaled the head of another onto its antenna and was dragging another lifeless body along. And it was like a full-scale battle between two rival colonies. I began paying more attention to the ants, watching their movements, their conflicts, their coordination. And I started filming them, capturing their everyday lives and struggles. Their activities, their actions, whether it is battling, foraging or rescuing, all were clearly purposeful. But I couldn't decipher them all alone. That's when I decided to reach out to entomologists. They helped me to understand the complex world, you know, that I was glimpsing.
You noticed the behavior that you called it kind of like a gang-like behavior. What did the entomologist tell you about that?
For instance, I learned that these ant battles often occur between rival colonies over resources such as food, territory, or sometimes even to steal the larvae. These battles are highly organized, with soldier ants leading the charge to protect their colony and its queen, because once the queen is caught or killed, the war is lost, because without the queen, there is no nest.
So what other peculiar behaviors did you notice in ants?
The most intriguing thing is the communication. Ants use pheromones, chemicals which act like kind of like a GPS for other colony members. This pheromone communication is really something. They have different kinds of pheromone release to alert about the battle, inform about the food source, and a lot more. I also learned that there are social hierarchy and specialized roles. There are worker ants, soldier ants, and there is this slave-making ants. Yes, as the name goes, take slaves. These ants, they actually mimic the pheromones of the enemy ants whose nests they are going to invade and disrupt the communication. And this slave-making ants, they invade other colonies, especially to steal larvae, which they raise as workers in their own nests. This parasitic behaviors is really helping them to expand their colonies without using much effort themselves.
Very interesting. Subhagunam, if I see a colony of ants, my reaction is like, oh, how am I going to get rid of them? You know, I don't want them taking over my place, you know. But you were fascinated by their behavior and started filming them. Where does this fascination with insects come from?
While I was growing up, there were lots of natural shrubs, trees around my home. I would often explore that wild area. I would fill glass bottles with as many insects as I could find and then spend days observing them. However, as a child, I didn't understand the importance of oxygen. So those insects would die eventually. My mom would scold me for these activities. But it was through this curiosity that I started exploring the macro world and began to admire the amazing wonders unfolding before us.
Wow. I was watching the video that you produced. It is quite dramatic. You know, there is high action is happening. How did you feel watching this, all of this drama unfold on your camera?
Seeing all the drama unfolding right in front of my lens is honestly mesmerizing. It's like stepping into a whole different world where these tiny creatures are living out of, complex stories of survival, sacrifice, and strategy. There is something deeply captivating.
What's up with the ants in your house today? What are they up to these days?
Actually, this is a rainy season in Tamil Nadu, and the ants are very actively foraging, because while there is a rain, there will be a battle to steal the food sources. So they are collecting as much food they can, and they are trying to protect it.
Thank you, Subhagunam Kenan of BBC Tamil. And if you have an ant infestation, you know who not to call. Now, I want to take you for a ride. A train ride. A new international railway has opened between Thailand and Laos as part of a plan to boost the economy of both countries. My colleague and train enthusiast, Thuong Le from BBC Vietnamese, decided to go on an impromptu journey and she sent us this report.
Recently, I had an unforgettable overnight train adventure traveling from Bangkok, Thailand to Vientiane, the capital of Laos. The idea struck me on one weekend while I was watching travel videos about the newly inaugurated train route. Laos and Thailand officially opened the first direct railway connecting their capital. And the train number 133 departs from Bangkok 9:25 p.m. and arriving in Vientiane at 9:05 a.m. in the next morning, making the 650-kilometer journey last around 12 hours. The startup spending the night on a train and, you know, waking up to a sunrise in an unfamiliar country was thrilling for me. I really, really liked that. So just on a Friday evening, I just grabbed my backpack and made my way to the Krung Thep Amphiwat Station, also known as Bang Sue Grand Station. It's the largest railway station in Southeast Asia. And I arrived just half an hour before departure. It took less than 2 minutes to present my passport and then pay. And then afterward, I just to enter the platform where everyone else line up orderly to board and carrying their own luggage. And one thing that I really like there is that the train departed and arrived exactly on the schedule. So the train resembled other Thai trains. And the first class section was quite modern and comfortable. I was so surprised to find the train nearly full with only non-air conditioned seat left. So with no other option, I had to buy a one-way ticket in the cheapest class for 281 baht, which is approximately $8. So, you know, embracing the challenge. When I was a student, I used trains a lot. Because I study in Ho Chi Minh City, a city in the south of Vietnam. And whenever, you know, it's holiday, then I go back to my hometown in the central of Vietnam by the train. It's a very slow vehicle. And the journeys were often bumpy. And it was full of noises from fellow passengers and the constant noise of vendors. But it was fun because I had the chance to talk to many strangers. And actually, I made some friends because it's a long journey. There was no internet, nothing. And then I just talked to strangers and then make friends with them. And also, like, at every station in every province, then I can stop and try their food. Even now that I still remember which station has what kind of food that I like. And, you know, like, I had the chance to watch all the beautiful landscape from the train as well. So except the nighttime where, you know, the sky is black and I cannot see anything outside. But in daytime, it's really nice to see, you know, all the, you know, like, dragon fruit field or the green field, things like that. So on that day of my journey, I tried to make friends of some, you know, fellow passenger with me. First, I saw that most of the passengers are mostly workers, along with few tourists from Western country and Japan. And in my economy carriages, I sat across a middle-aged Laotian man, and I tried to start a conversation by offering a snack to him. And he accepted with a smile, and he nodded. But I think he doesn't speak English. During the trip, he just stayed quiet. There were two women in their 40s with large batch of Thai food. I don't know. It was unclear for me if they were, you know, like, buying the food from Thailand and selling back to Laos. And they seems very experienced with the train travel. When they just board, they quickly arranging their pillow. And then after, once we left the city, you know, darkness just arrived. And it became very, very quiet. I can just only hear the noise from the railway. Oh, it was so bumpy and I couldn't reply. There was no aircon, so there was fan just above my head, so I couldn't sleep. It got better when I finally saw the sunrise. During the night, I couldn't see anything outside of the window, but then later I started to see, you know, like, green field with, I think, buffalo or cow, quite refreshing. because I'm living in Bangkok, which is, you know, a concrete jungle. It was all green and I really like that. So it was a short trip, but I really like it because Vientiane is very quiet, very small, and less chaotic. But still, it has some unique charm, and people are very, very friendly. And they always greeting visitor with, you know, sabai di, which means hello. The Thai Ministry of Transport estimated that this train line will accommodate around 200,000 passengers each year, generating the revenue of at least 67 million baht, which is about $1.5 million. The new train route can connect Laos to high-speed railway leading into China, and this railway runs from the border town of Yunnan province to Vientiane. So when the two train lines connect, it would transform Laos from a landlocked nation into a vital transportation hub. Definitely, I want to take the next train, the high-speed one, all the way from Thailand to Laos and then to China. But of course, it must be a sleeper cabin. I will make sure to buy a ticket in advance.
Thuan Le from BBC Vietnamese. I think she'll definitely remember to buy her ticket in advance next time. I'm Farhanaik Hamidi. The Fifth Floor team this week was
Alicia Joya,
Caroline Ferguson,
and
Hannah Dean.
The sound engineers were
Giles Aspen
and
Sue Mayo.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.